Welcome to People in Exile, where we have conversations, host interviews, discuss books, and engage with the Bible to help believers live out their faith in an unbelieving world.
Welcome to this episode of People in Exile. I'm your host for this episode, Chris Chambers, and I'm here, as always, with
Ben Ellis
and
Andrew Chamberlain.
And this evening, we have the opportunity of having a conversation with Andrew's father, Mr. Doug Chamberlain. How are you doing, Doug?
Doing fine.
Very good, very good. So what we want to do in this particular episode, we want to talk to you a little bit about, you know, who you are, kind of how what your story is, how you came to faith in Christ. I want to talk about what you've done for your career, including what led you to the mission field over in Spain. We want to talk about that a little bit. We want to then talk about kind of what you do in your spare time, the importance of discipleship in your life, importance of evangelism as well. We want to talk about what it is that how it is that you you make time for daily communication with God. If you have any mentors that have mentored you over the years, or encouraged you, or folks that you've maybe mentored, I want to talk about that a little bit. And then what we'll do, we like to kind of shut down the episode with a little rapid fire section. So that's how we'll end that. All right. All right, man. Well, as always, who is Doug Chamberlain?
Well, I am, as you said, Andrew's father, and I came to Florida here with him about a year ago after retiring from working on the mission field in Spain.
All right. And so you were born when?
Born in 1951.
All right. So you're currently?
68 years old.
All right. Very good. And let's see. You're married?
Yes.
To Patty?
Correct.
And you have, like you said, Andrew, and you have another, you have a daughter, and she's older than Andrew, right?
That's correct.
And what's her name?
Leah.
And she lives?
She lives in Toledo, Ohio.
And interesting fact, she actually attends A.W. Tozer's church, is that right?
He was the original founder of that church, and that's where she attends.
And she works, she's a children's director?
Yes, she's director of children's ministry.
All right.
And we just assume she's smarter than Andrew, correct?
And boss.
Put him in a bad spot there.
That's the whole intent.
Yeah, no doubt, no doubt. Okay, so you grew up where?
Grew up in southern Ohio.
All right, and your father was a?
He was a pastor. Mm-hmm. Most of my life he pastored the same church. He was, when I was in Ohio, he pastored the same church.
What was the name of that church?
Porter Free Will Baptist Church.
Okay, and you actually were showing me, what is it? Was that called? The directory,
Director.
Yeah, with the pictures and everything. And you actually had quite a few members of your family that attended that church.
Well, before I left Ohio, all of my brothers and sisters attended there, and their children, as children were born into the family.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we spoke about your children. You actually also have how many grandchildren?
I have five.
Five grandchildren. Mm-hmm. Three here and then two up in,
Ohio.
In Ohio. Mm-hmm. Very good. And you mentioned you moved here not too long ago, and you came from Spain. Right.
Right.
We'll get to that here in just a few minutes. But so you grew up in the church then?
Definitely.
Yeah. I grew up with parents who were just teaching Jesus on a daily basis, living their relationship with Christ every day.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Definitely.
Were you was your testimony one of rebellion? Was it one of? I mean, all of us are in rebellion. But was it one of which you didn't want anything to do with your parents' faith, or is it one in which at a fairly early age you accepted Jesus and your relationship with Him?
Yes, I accepted Christ at a very early age, 8 years old, and never was rebellious other than the fact that, oh, do I have to go to church tonight?
Right.
And that was about the extent of my rebellion.
Y'all were in church all the time, weren't
you? In church all the time. I remember one point in time when my dad was holding some revivals, and I didn't do it because of my spirituality, but I attended church 32 nights in a row, I believe it was.
Oh, that's a bunch.
Now, when you're saying...
You never got in trouble in those 32 nights, did you?
I don't know.
Now, when you're saying revival, this is where basically the church sets out a date and said, "Hey, we're gonna have evangelists come in, or a single evangelist, or multiple evangelists."
Normally, it was back at that time. It was normally a week or 2 weeks. Wasn't unusual to have a 2-week revival service at a
Did it elongate it because a lot of people were responding? Or?
Sometimes that. And the other thing was, it was, at that time, many of the families, it was a single family income, and church was the place to go. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't hard to have a good attendance each evening.
So you mentioned 32 nights in a row. So what was it? What was going on? Do you remember exactly what was going on during that particular event?
We had a revival at our church probably 2 weeks, and then somewhere in that prior to that and afterwards, my dad held revival in another church. So I just went with him.
So this was almost more of a series of community events.
Yes.
As opposed to a singular church event.
Yeah, there were several small churches in our community. Mm-hmm. And they would many times just use the local pastors. Sometimes they would be somebody come from out of town.
So, your testimony. What you said 8 years old.
8 years
what,
old.
What is it that happened at age eight? That you can point back and say that's when
my brother got saved. Mm-hmm. We were at church on Sunday night, and after we got home, I definitely distinctly remember my dad asking my younger brother. He said, "You look like you were very interested in the service tonight and the, the invitation." And he said, "Yes." He said, "Well, would you like to give your heart to the Lord now?" And he said, "Yes, I would." So he prayed with my brother. And I sat there and kind of watched and listened to the whole thing. And then when he got done praying with him, he said, "Doug, how about you? Would you like to be saved?" And I said, "Yes." Mm-hmm. And so.
How cool. So three brothers in one night?
Two brothers.
Oh, Denny, I thought you said one got saved at church?
No, he was just very interested at church.
Oh.
But,
wow.
So that's.
Now, so you got saved at home?
At home. January 8th.
January the 8th. Mm-hmm. Very cool.
Would you say that there was immediate change that took place?
Yes.
Okay. How so? Like what?
Well, I was always the one that kind of argued or discussed, why do I have to do this or why do I have to do that? And I remember my dad a couple of weeks later saying, "You're just willing to help. You're willing to do anything." Said, "I've really seen a change in you." Mm-hmm. I mean, he saw the change more than I did.
Sure. Absolutely. So so you're 8 years old at that point, so you've probably been in, second, third grade, something like that, I guess, at that time? Somewhere around there, right?
Third or fourth, yes.
Oh,
third or fourth.
I think you told me this one time, but wasn't it your school teacher?
Yes.
Tell us that one.
Yes, on Monday morning, after the Sunday night that I got saved, we were getting ready to go out to recess, and my teacher, she said, "Doug, I need you to stay in during recess." And I said, I thought I was in trouble. And she walked over and we sat down and she said, "Now tell me what you did." I said, I don't know. I don't know what I did." She said, "Oh, yes, you do." And I said, "I can't think of anything that I done."
So you're denying the faith already as an
I was denying it. I wasn't denying the faith. I was denying guilt. But this school teacher was a very good friend of one of my aunts. Mm. And my aunt had told her about this. Mm. And so she questioned me. And she said, "Sunday night, what did you do?" And I said, "Oh, I got saved." And she said, "That's the answer I was looking for." So I was at school then. I was being watched.
So you said 51, so this is about 1959 then or so. You were third or fourth grade at this point.
No, it wasn't 59. It was in 1961.
I'm sorry, 1961. Okay.
Well, I said you were eight.
1960, I'm sorry.
Okay. Yeah. And so you continue to go to school, you get to high school. Any issues in high school at all?
No, not really. As I was in school, I thought, I'm the worst Christian that ever lived. But as I got older and got to seeing what other people done and how some people had lived that professed to be a Christian, in my own eyes, I really wasn't that bad. Mm-hmm. I never had a issue with drinks or drugs or smoking or any of that kind of thing that was considered bad. Mm-hmm. But yet, I knew I wasn't perfect, but I realized that my teenage years and my younger years, there was not a lot of regrets.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Big thing for you, if I'm failing to remember, was work. I mean, you were working from what age?
Oh, I had my own lawns to mow by the time I was 12 years old.
Oh, okay.
And worked farm work and picked strawberries. And
no time to get in trouble.
No, not much. And I was loaning my dad money, so it was, you know, that's why he kept me in work, I think.
Was that a daddy tax? Is that what that was?
Now, he liked to buy and sell cars, so we went in partnership on a few.
Oh, really? And, that's neat. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, so you're already kind of doing some business, mowing lawns, those kind of things. You get to high school. After high school, what do you do?
After high school, I decided I had two brothers older than me that went to college, and one of my brothers graduated from a Bible college, and I thought, this would probably help me. And I think I shocked my parents, mm-hmm. because all through high school, I never brought a book home. I never done any homework at home. If I couldn't get it done at school, and I was basically a B student, and that was good enough. Mm-hmm. And I did not think I was college material, and neither did my parents, because they knew that I would rather be working as studying. Mm-hmm. But I went for a semester. I saved my own money and paid my way. And about a month into college, I decided this wasn't for me, but I worked and still had, you know, I had a job all the time I was in school. So I thought, well, I'm not going to be a quitter. I'll stick it out for the year. Mm-hmm. And basically, when I came home and said I wasn't going back, Dad said, I'm not surprised. Mm-hmm. And so then I began working full time and done okay.
Yeah. And then what you said full time, what were you doing at the time?
Started out working in a flower shop. Then I went to truck driving. Then I worked in auto parts. And then I landed my first real job in a steel mill. And that lasted 2 years and they closed it down. Mm-hmm. So then shortly after that, my wife and I moved to Tennessee and became children's house parents.
When did you meet your wife?
I met my wife at church while she was dating my neighbor.
Okay.
I met her when in the summer of, that would have been 1970.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And how long did y'all date before you got married?
About a year and a half.
Okay. All right. Mm-hmm. And you would have been how old at that time then?
I was 21
when you got married. 19 mm-hmm. when you met her, though, right?
19 or 20.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, about 19, probably.
And how long after that did you have your daughter?
Well, we had a son prior to our daughter that we lost him in an automobile accident. Mm-hmm. But we were married 4 years before we had our first child.
So about 25 you had your first child?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay.
So back up, because I know a little bit about because you're my dad, but the steel mill is a big deal.
Steel mill,
okay. In that area, because that was like once you got on the steel mill, everybody you were set.
You were.
But that kind of collapsed for
that
you, right?
Collapsed.
Well, collapsed for everybody. Mm-hmm. What year did it go down in Southern Ohio? Because I think Youngstown was like 71 or something like that.
Youngstown was probably a little after
75
that.
Something.
Yeah, because I started in 1973 and got laid off for good in 75, and the steel mill shut down shortly after that.
Because this is where you see all that, like, rust belt, you know, mm-hmm. all that stuff, mm-hmm. yeah.
And there was no work there, so that's when we moved to Tennessee.
And help me out, Philip, losing Philip and the steel mill, that was pretty close together, correct?
Pretty close. I actually stayed around Southern Ohio for a couple years, worked a couple jobs, just surviving, basically.
But, I mean, what happened first, Philip passing or the steel mill?
The steel mill first. Philip was born in 1977.
Okay. So you stayed around a couple years?
Stayed around a couple years, and then we lost Philip. And then one evening I told my wife, I said, we're starving to death at what I'm doing, so I'm going to go in tomorrow and turn my notice in mm-hmm. and do something. She said, well, whatever. And about 20 minutes after I said that, got a knock on the door, and it was actually my sister, but the director of the children's home in Tennessee had called, and I had never been there. I knew it existed, but that was it. Mm-hmm. And he called and offered us a job. So 2 weeks later, we were in Tennessee working with.
Now, how did you get connected from the children's home? I mean, we're going from a steel mill to a children's home. It seems like a really kind of dynamic transition.
Can I do something before we get there?
Yes.
If I could go back, okay. Obviously losing a child at a very young age, it sounds like. Would you mind talking a little bit more about that?
My wife had just taken him. He was 2.5 months old. She had just taken him to have his first pictures made. Mm-hmm. They used to set up these photographers in department stores and different things. And actually, her and my sister-in-law went because she had a baby just a little bit older. And she had just dropped her off, and on the way home, then the accident happened, and we lost our son. He was killed immediately in the in the accident. And that particular time, we were, I mean, we never lost our faith in God whatsoever. We never blamed him. It was, we were pretty well grounded. But we began praying and searching and trying to figure out what God was going to do for us or what we were going to do. And naturally, my wife, she was injured pretty heavily in the accident herself. So for months, she couldn't do much of anything. And then we began to pray and say, God, Philip is yours. Any other children we have beyond this point will be yours. So we started talking about adopting just to see if we liked that, if that would work for us or how we were going to handle another child. I called the, it wasn't adopting, it was foster parenting. And I called the office in town, and the girl that answered the phone, she said, what's your name? And I told her, and she said, oh, I know you. She said, you graduated the year ahead of me. She said, when do you want a child? Tomorrow? And I said, let's talk about it first. I was just getting some information. And she said, well, anytime you call, you've got a child. So that was a little scary in a way. Well, then we talked about it, prayed about it. And then, like I said, I told my wife I was quitting my job. And the man in Tennessee, actually a good friend of mine, married the director's daughter. And he recommended me. And so 2 weeks after that call, we were in Tennessee working, taking care of seven teenage boys.
Ooh, wow, what a jump.
So one of the themes I'm picking up on was, you know, you grew up Christian home, Christian family, not a wild testimony, but just faithfulness. You know, the Bible talks about strive to live a quiet life. And so with that, I mean, is that a fair characterization?
Yes, it is. I can remember at 16 years of age in a mission conference wanting to be a missionary. But at that particular time, all I knew about missionaries was church planting. And I thought, I can't be a preacher. I'm not a preacher. I can't plant a church. But if I knew somebody that was going to go plant one, I would go help him. That was my attitude.
And you said that was at 16?
At 16. And as, you know, I got married and started working, and that kind of got pushed back. But it was always there. I could tell you the date and where I was sitting in the church. It was just always on my mind. But I thought, no, I just, there's no such job as a missionary. That was as a child, that's what I thought. And I began working in the church. I taught Sunday school. I drove church bus. I was there every time there was a work day. Those things, that was my interest.
Let me ask you this. One of the things that we've spoken about quite a bit in the podcast already is the idea of calling, right? The idea of our call. What is it, and again, for you at age 16 that really has led to you ultimately going to the mission field, what is it that was different about that than you know, just a feeling of, hey, maybe a desire to do this or a desire to do that? What was different about that?
Well, the difference was that whoever was speaking that night used the standard verse, Matthew, in Matthew, where, you know, go ye into all the world and preach the gospel. And in Acts 1:8, tells you that you'll receive power after the Holy Ghost has come upon you, and you shall be witnesses. I never thought that a Christian should be anything but somebody to go and tell, even though I did not know the procedures and what to do and how to do it. And I wasn't really an evangelist. I mean, I was not an outspoken Christian at church or at school. I just tried to live a decent life. And I just never felt that, never had that burning desire that I have to be on the mission field. But at the same time, I always had that desire that if the opportunity was right, I would go.
So let me, because I think you asked a good question there, Chris. We're talking about the call or whatnot. That's where I get back to the idea of faithfulness. And I feel like I have a little bit of insight, you being my dad, and I've seen that steadiness. Do you feel like it's just been a call to faithfulness, whatever it is, wherever it is, whenever it is?
Yes.
Because, I mean, you've held a lot of different positions, done a lot of different things, but they've all kind of focused around.
They focused around some type of ministry or some type of servant work. And that is, I know when we went to Spain, I wasn't there no time, and the field director, he said, well, tell me about your calling. And I said, can't tell you I really had one. I said, I think all Christians are called. I said, I think if you, the way I read the Bible and the way I understand it, we're all told to go. And I said, some can go on a foreign field and some can't. I don't know what my qualifications for being here, other than that I was willing to come. He said, that's the way it ought to be. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was his answer to me. He said,
absolutely.
He said, that's pretty much like mine.
So, kind of going back on kind of the timeline here, steel mill closes. You lose your young son. You you're getting ready to quit the job that you had, and you get a call from the children's home. Was the children's home was that a Christian organization?
Yes, it was a Christian organization.
Okay, so it's, I mean, in a way, you took on a vocational, a full-time vocational kind of ministry position.
Exactly.
At that point, and was that a full-time job then?
Yes, it was.
It was okay. Mm-hmm. And you said they had 17 children?
I had 7 teenagers in our house.
Okay, 17.
Teenage boys.
So it might as well have been 17 children.
Yeah.
although a year and a half later, we moved to a house of about 6 or 7 young girls.
Mm-hmm.
Patty said, why did we do this?
Yeah.
This is crazy. I'd rather have the boys.
Is that right? So what did that entail, the children's home?
We were house parents. The children actually lived in the home with us. We were their spiritual advisor, so to speak. We were the family figure, the mother and father figure. We took them to church. We had devotions nearly every night. We just tried to live and be an example to them in our everyday life. During the day, I worked as a maintenance man and as a farmhand. We raised our own beef. We raised our own hay. I spent many hours on a tractor, many of hours remodeling houses, and I loved every bit of it. You know, that was just right. That was my calling.
Mm-hmm.
And but you know, in the evening, then I became a father to the kids. And
so it also entails, like, I'm assuming, getting them to school, helping with their homework, all that kind of stuff.
Yes.
Right. Mm-hmm. And did they go to a public school or?
Part time they went to public school. Part of the time they tried school there at the children's home, because some of the kids had missed so much school prior to coming to the children's home, so we kind of developed a program that would help them there.
So how long were you at this first home?
I was there about three and a half years.
Three and a half years. Mm-hmm. And was it a, do you sign a contract with that, or you just take a position?
Just
what
took
is that?
A position.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And then 3.5 years you and Patty, I guess, felt like...
We had our own child, and
okay.
Our daughter was born with a hip problem, and she had to have a couple surgeries.
Mm-hmm.
She was in a body cast for about a year.
Uh-oh.
We just felt like it was time to, she required a lot of our time.
Mm-hmm.
And as much as we loved the children's home, we also knew we weren't devoting as much time to the kids as we were our own because of her medical condition. So we resigned, but we stayed in the community, continued going to the church there for a while. I was a Sunday school teacher. We worked in the church just the same.
And so it wasn't really one of those things where you didn't want to continue with the kids. You just felt like due to the issues you were dealing with, you couldn't give them the time that they really needed.
Exactly.
At that point in their life. Okay. Mm-hmm. And then did you immediately go to this other home, or did you take a break from?
I went to work.
Back up. He had 3.5 years total.
3.5 years?
Yeah,
at that one total, right?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, between the boys and the girls?
Yeah.
Oh, okay,
yeah.
I got you.
Yeah, it was all one campus.
I got you. Oh, okay, I see.
We had about 30 kids at the time.
I see.
I mean, the home did.
I got you. So after that 3.5 years ends, you now have a daughter, and she has some medical issues that you're dealing with, and then what do you do vocationally at that point?
Well, I told one of the men in the church that I was... going to be leaving the home and looking for a job. I said, I like it here. He said, I'll find you a job.
Mm-hmm.
He was an accountant in town and knew a lot of businesses. That was like on a Friday. On Sunday, he said, I got you an interview with an air freight company in town. They need a parts manager for a their airplanes. Mm-hmm. And he said, I knew in talking to you, you'd had some parts experience when you were in high school. So I went in and they hired me, and I worked there for them for 7 or 8 years, and that closed down. The company that bought it wanted me to move to Texas, but I did not choose to do that. I came back home, and we actually moved back to Ohio for about a year. I worked for a large air freight company, Emory Worldwide, which they've merged with Federal Express over the years. Hmm. And done that for about a year, but we went back to Tennessee. And then the man that had started the air freight company that I had worked for, he now had a trucking company, and he hired me for them, and I worked for him for about 25 years in different positions.
Now, so Andrew comes along during that first 7 years with air freight, the air freight company?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. What kind of changes, if any, did that bring to the family, having a second?
Chaos.
Yeah.
No, it really didn't change a whole lot. Leah was older, and she had gotten over her medical.
And how much older is she than Andrew?
She's 4 years older than Andrew.
All right.
And on Mother's Day, when Leah was about 6 or 7 years old, she got saved at a church. There was a new church plant in town that we were working with some. I actually helped build the new building, so I'd done a lot of work on it, you know, after hours of working all day. And we attended that church for a couple years, and then moved back to the Limestone Church. And we had to leave that church because one night in Sunday night service, Andrew was sitting down at the other end of the pew, and the preacher was preaching, and Andrew told the preacher to shut up. And
come on, man.
The preacher said, well, Andrew, I'm not finished yet. And he began preaching again, and he said, I said, shut up, you're giving me a headache. No, we weren't asked to leave, but
probably safer if you did anyway.
No, we were still in pretty good standings there for a while, but
I ruined that one.
Andrew causing trouble everywhere he goes.
Yeah, it's kind of the theme.
So we went to another church where we were maybe a little better known. Some people knew us.
So let me ask you this: you would again 3.5 years in the children's home. You at age 16 kind of felt that call to some kind of a full-time vocational ministry position. You then find yourself, though, for quite a few years in a secular business. Mm-hmm. Do you believe that you can both be both an evangelistic and a disciple maker even in those jobs? And,
oh, definitely.
And let me ask it a different way. How were you evangelistic and a disciple maker in those jobs?
Probably didn't do as good as I should
have.
But I was a dispatcher for a trucking company for several years. And, the old saying goes in the business, how do you tell if a dispatcher is lying? And it's when he opens his mouth.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And they asked me to become a dispatcher, and I told them, I said, I don't qualify. And they said, well, what do you mean you don't? I said, well, I don't lie, I don't cuss, and I don't smoke. And they said, well, you'll be doing all that within 6 months if you take this job. And I said, well, promise me if I do, if you hear me cussing, see me smoking, or catch me in a lie, that you'll fire me on the spot. I said, I just, I'm not going to let that job do that to me. And I stayed with them about 17 years or so. And
Never did they fire you, obviously.
No, they never fired me. Matter of fact, I quit them 3 times and they called me back.
Well, one of the things that we've spoken about is the importance as Christians, right, to not simply do our job, but we are called to do our job very, very well. Mm-hmm. As well. And as Christians, I think that is even more important, since we are essentially taking Christ into the workplace. So mm-hmm. we want to make sure that those around us not only see us proclaiming the gospel and proclaiming Christ, but also doing everything we can to help the business, help our employees or employers and coworkers. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I had many opportunities to somewhat share the gospel. As a dispatcher, I talked with truck drivers all day long, mm-hmm. every day. I have dealt with families where we had a truck driver that actually got murdered while on duty.
Wow.
He was in Los Angeles, and I was on duty at night when we got the call. Had another time when one of the men was out and his son died instantly. And again, I had to deal with that. Another time, a man was in, he was out west, on his way out west, and his daughter was hurt in a very serious car accident. And I was able, and I know it was the power of God, but I was able to find a team that was close to him where within 20 minutes I had him with another load going back. And he was in South Dakota, and we don't have any business there. But I had him headed back to Columbus, Ohio, with a load, and the other team took the load back to Washington where he was headed. Mm-hmm. And that's all. God was in it all, because I couldn't do those things on my own. But I always tried to be fair and honest with the drivers, and I did not ever deny my faith with them. I was very limited on what I could talk to them over the telephone for a couple minutes. Mm-hmm. But yet, I had one man tell me one time, he said, "Doug, anything you do, if you need to load cover, just call me and say I need you." And he said, "You've never lied to me." He said, "If I can help you, I will." And I've had others pretty much do the same thing. Mm-hmm. And I had another dispatcher introduce a man in the business, was showing him around there one day, and he said, "Here's the unique dispatcher." Said, "I've worked with him for about 3 years now," and said, "I've never heard him curse." Mm-hmm. And the guy said, "In this job?" Mm-hmm. So, and I'm not saying that to brag. I'm saying that's how God worked. And
So one of the things you stated was you left him three times, and they brought you back every time.
Yeah.
Why'd they bring you back?
I guess my reputation, ability.
So with that, I mean, you felt like part of your testimony was being successful working with them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, did they, when they brought you back, did they ever talk about any of that to you?
Not much. I mean, I went to Spain. I came back. They hired me back in a better position than I had. Then I left and went to a children's home, and they hired me back again. And one other time, maybe I only got hired back two. I left them three times, got hired back two times. I guess that's...
Yeah, because you retired from
them. Yeah. I retired.
So I want to talk about Spain a little bit. Before I do that, though, you were mentioning some of these obviously very difficult situations that some of the individuals that you're working with dealt with. How do you think losing Philip allowed you to really minister in a special way to those individuals going through those difficult times?
Well, we had been through it. Mm-hmm. We knew the grief. We knew the suffering. We knew the sadness. But then I think it was just my faith in Christ and the fact that as I talked to drivers, you know, I would get involved in their personal lives some. I got a letter once I got back into Spain the first time, and this truck driver's wife wrote me a letter, and she said, "You'll never know how much you meant to Larry," that was his name, said he made fun of Christians, and he said, "Well, I'll never make fun of Doug." Mm-hmm. And, you know, again, it's just allowing God to control my conversation, to control everything.
Yeah.
You know, I would get upset the same as the rest of them were, but I would not express it in the same way, I guess you would say.
So you mentioned you left this job and you went to Spain. How did that come about?
Well, our daughter, by this time, she had, well, in high school, she had made several mission trips. Her desire was to be a missionary.
Mm-hmm.
She went to Bible college and graduated with a double major in missions and in Bible.
Mm-hmm.
She has been to Russia, Africa, Cuba, Puerto Rico.
Good to walk.
Yeah, well, Africa, yeah, Ivory Coast. And that was her whole life. Exposing her to that, we became more and more aware of the need for missionaries.
Mm-hmm.
And Patty kept talking about it, and I said, "Well, you know, if the Lord leads, we'll do it. I have no problem with that." Andrew was just starting in high school, and he wasn't too concerned about the mission field at the time. But he wasn't being rebellious. I remember him one day telling me, said, "Dad, why do we need to go to Spain?" He said, "I could win one person to the Lord every day for the rest of my life and probably never get all the rest of them here in our town." Mm. So he said, "Why leave?" And so we just prayed about it and prayed about it. And he went on a mission trip.
Well, let me back up on that mission trip. If I'm not mistaken, I thought I was going to a basketball camp. And I think Mom did a little switcheroo on me because somehow I was in a basketball camp. I was at missions camp, and I hated that week because that was the same week as basketball. But then once I got there, God did a big work on my heart.
I remember when you come home after the trip, said, I'll go tomorrow if you want to. And a matter of fact, the first time we went to Spain, Andrew actually went a couple months before we went because school was starting.
Mm-hmm. Well, along those lines, you know, you mentioned the question, why is it that we have to go there, we can do mm-hmm. what we need here? What kind of reliance on God is there when you're in a foreign country, not speaking your language?
There is a lot. Mm-hmm. I won't say I was ever scared mm-hmm. because we didn't go to some third world country. We went to nearly Madrid, Spain, a very safe place to live. But that was the first time in my life that I ever depended, other than when I was a child. I told you I worked, had my own money from the time I was about 12 years old. Wasn't wealthy, but if I wanted something, I could figure out how to get it. But that was the first time that I ever depended on somebody else supporting us. Mm-hmm. That was difficult for me. Mm-hmm. I tried to justify why I'm there all the time I was there. Why does people want to pay and send this kind of money for what I'm doing? Mm-hmm. And
what is it that you were doing?
Well, it's interesting because we applied to the mission board and says, we, you know, put us wherever. We just want to be a help. Mm-hmm. And so several of the missionaries who knew our family, we had offers from Uruguay, Japan, Spain, France, I believe. And the time it narrowed all down, Spain seemed like the fit. They had just, we were going to be working, and we did, in a Christian school for missionary kids, an English-speaking school. Mm-hmm. And they had just opened a new building. There was some maintenance work that still needed to be done on it. And they was setting up a library, computerizing a library. Well, that's what my wife had her education in. Hmm. So it just fit perfectly. We went over. She was the librarian. She computerized the library. And I worked with finishing up the finishing touches on the building and then worked in the finance office and done a lot of different things. I was not a teacher, but just filled the role of what normally they didn't have anybody else to do. Hmm. And loved every moment of it.
So, you know, so I think there's some folks that think the term missionary and think, all right, this is somebody who's going somewhere and what they're going to do 24 hours a day, 7 days a week is simply evangelize everywhere they go. And it's not a realistic expectation of what a missionary is, right?
No. Sometimes evangelizing is not, even in Spain, because Christianity is such a rare thing, you know, we
Protestant. There's a lot of Catholic.
There's a lot of Catholic, yes. Evangelical Christian, mm-hmm. we would say. A lot of times we were instructed, don't ever use the terminology missionary because mm-hmm. that, you know, they think of, you know, some cult. Mm-hmm. So you just build friendships and establish yourself as just, you know, I'm your neighbor. Mm-hmm. I'm not your missionary.
So,
I'm your neighbor.
So I'll tell one on them because how that happened. Like the people we rented our house from. So my mom and dad didn't speak Spanish. People we rented our house from. Long story short, the young guy, he had parents, but their son, he was the one that owned the house, got injured, mm-hmm. and just through my mom and dad's cordialness, I think is a good way of saying it, friendliness, because they couldn't really tell them about Christ. They didn't even know how to say many words in Spanish at this point.
Not at that
point. Anyway, he gets injured, and they had built somewhat of a relationship, and we went to visit just out of kindness, because that's, you know, any normal people would do. You know, you go visit, somebody's hurt, right? But that moment allowed us a privilege that, I don't mean this in a braggadocious way, many missionaries didn't even have yet, because at that point we developed, I mean, we were going over for dinner, mm-hmm. everything else. I'll never forget, I had to pray in Spanish that time, and I was the only, you know, it was rough, but it was really interesting to see how the sovereignty of God, you didn't set out for this evangelistic mm-hmm. task, but God set it up, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. and it was all through availability and being open. Is that a fair way of
saying
it?
That's a fair way, very much.
I'm going to bring in Ben here for a minute for this. Now, Ben, you just actually preached a message on evangelism in particular. I think one of the things you said was, what, evangelism isn't what we do. It is who we are.
Who we are. Yeah, it's who we are. It's not what we do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so whether you're here in the U.S. or whether you're in Spain on the mission field, it doesn't matter what you're doing, right? By sharing the gospel, spreading mm-hmm. the news, just, again, the outpouring of just who Jesus is inside of us is going to mm-hmm. lead to that, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one of the themes that Andrew was trying to shape the conversation into, picking up, was this idea of faithfulness. And, mm-hmm. and I think that really, and obviously, Doug, correct me if I am misperceiving this here, but really that faithfulness is really almost an outflow of that "this is who we are, not what we do" kind of mentality. It's like between the cordialness, the friendliness that, mm-hmm. that Andrew was talking about with your guys' original landlord and the guy you were renting the house from. It was just this idea of, look, this is who we are, this is what we do, this is how we live. Welcome to being our friend, you know. Exactly. and that was what built the bridge into a larger construct of actually having an opportunity to share the gospel.
And I'll never forget, we took him to a Protestant church, and he used the word to us, like, nacer is to be born in Spanish. And mm-hmm. and he used it. I'll never forget this. He's like, it's like I've been born again. Mm. And it was an incredible moment. You don't know what all that means, at least for us seeing the situation. It's exactly what you're saying. It was like, nobody planned this. We weren't, mm-hmm. we didn't go for some strategy session on how to, and I'm not opposed to those things, you know, but it was just, God opened that door, faithfulness was there, and God provided the means, so.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Let me ask you this. There's another missionary at our church I've spoken to, spent some time with in the past, and one of the things he mentioned is where he was, he was in Russia, and then he was in Africa, North Africa in particular. And he's mentioned the fact that while he was over there, you know, he got used to living with much less than he was used to living over here. Again, there was the reliance on God, the requirement from day to day was so intense. He said he got back here and a bit of that has waned. And he's not obviously proud of that fact, but he said that's something that he's certainly seen. Have you seen much of a difference from being on the mission field to being still on the mission field here, but not in the same context?
Oh, very much. And not to be critical of the culture and the society here in the United States, but we have too much. Mm-hmm. I mean, we the grocery store, we never have to cook a meal here if we don't want to. You can go to the grocery store and you can find any ready-made meal you want. Mm-hmm. And in Spain, still to this day, it's getting more Americanized. But still to this day, you go to the butcher shop and get your meat. You go to the fruit stand and get your fruit. You go to their life is simpler.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that is a good
thing. Through less,
yes. Yeah. I mean, they're not poor, they're not destitute, and they don't do without. But they have not got that mindset that we have to have it all. You know, mm-hmm. the cars are small and very economical. The clothing is, they can go, they don't buy the name brands in some situations. Mm-hmm. It's just a simpler way of life. Family is still important. Mm-hmm. Neighbors is important. Community is important. And
let me ask you this. Obviously, you grew up in you know, the American church, right, mm-hmm. Here. You go into another context. Another culture. Mm-hmm. Was there much, if any, contextualization that was required in sharing the good news, sharing the gospel in that culture? Or did you find that wasn't really necessary in that particular culture?
Wasn't really necessary. And again, I speak of one who, you know, I did not ever have a good handle on the language.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know what people were saying about me when I walked away from them. And so, therefore, I did not get into a lot of conversations about the gospel, mm-hmm. because I would have been very hard-pressed to even know what they were asking if they asked me a question. Not that I didn't have, you know, I could have answered a lot of things in English. But in a culture like that, you can't do things like, you know, next week we're having vacation Bible school. They don't know what that is because they've not been they don't live in the church culture. Church
in the American culture. South.
Yeah. Or, you know, let's go to church.
Mm-hmm.
The Catholic Church was so powerful there that a lot of people considered it back in history. They were as strong as the government. Mm-hmm. So the church was not a good thing for a lot of them.
Mm-hmm.
They'll all tell you they're Catholic by name.
Yeah.
And some of them, you know, I think there's some believers. I think there's maybe more than maybe we give them credit for, because I've gotten acquainted with a lot of mm-hmm. people.
Mm-hmm.
But you can share your faith with them in a limited, I mean, you're only limited by your own vocabulary
mm-hmm.
in that particular culture. I have found, because I've done two different terms in Spain, we were there for 3 years back in the early 2000s, and then we came back. Probably 30% of the school population that we worked in were now local Spaniards, which mm-hmm. the families wanted to get their children into schools that were not secular, that were not teaching all the things that governments require to teach now. So there is a presence there, and there is a knowledge of God, and the friendships and the closeness is what brings those conversions about.
I'll chime in real quick on this one, if you don't mind. Just the story we talked about with the landlord, what I saw, and I think my parents, because it's not just the landlord, like my mom had a beautician that to this, well, I can't say it to this day because they're not in Spain, but right until they left, I'd still talk to her on the phone when she's over at my parents' house.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I saw through my mom and dad wasn't contextualization, it was just genuineness.
Mm-hmm.
Genuineness speaks in any culture,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I think people read that regardless of faith. And then when that genuineness is there and then there's faith there, I think that's a powerful, mm-hmm. powerful combination. And so there, and I'll say this with him being here, they had more of an evangelical push than some other missionaries, not to make it a competition,
yeah.
but just from we're just genuine everyday people,
mm-hmm.
and that related.
Mm-hmm. How important is it to have a wife that is, you know, as motivated as you are in going to the mission field, you know, where you're both on the same page?
She was probably at times more motivated mm-hmm. than I was.
Okay.
Just to be perfectly honest
mm-hmm.
with you.
Mm-hmm.
But it is very important.
Yeah.
I mean, we would not have stayed. And if one of us was fighting the other, it's time to go home, it's time to go home,
mm-hmm.
It would have, we had those conversations different times.
Yeah.
But at the same time, we both knew where we were supposed to be. And,
yeah. Well, this is what I think we'll do. We got about 5 minutes left for the episode. What I'd like to do, I'm going to start the rapid fire section a little bit early,
okay.
So I'm going to add a few questions to it, but we'll
okay.
do it in kind of rapid fire, okay? All right, so the first thing is this. Who are you currently learning from right now? And that could be, again, that could be a particular book of the Bible, author in Scripture. It could be, you know, a book that you're reading. Could be podcast you're listening to. Could be any of those things.
It's interesting. I think I'm learning more from the clients that I work with
okay.
right now than maybe any just hearing some of their testimonies and their changes
okay.
and how real God is.
Yeah. Now,
clients of what?
Of the ministry where we work, Jericho
yeah.
Road.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you're currently working at Jericho Road, and what that ministry is for?
For the homeless and the down and out.
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. And so you're currently learning from them. Let's see. Yeah. What do you do from it? You know, day in day out to ensure that you continue to grow and develop as a disciple of Christ?
Well, I have my prayer time, and some people might not agree with me, but I don't have a set morning devotion or an evening devotion. I do read. Sometimes it's in the afternoon, sometimes it's in the morning, sometimes it's in the evening. And I really take, I don't mean this to sound pious, but I believe it's in Philippians where we're told to pray without ceasing.
Mm-hmm.
I catch myself as I'm driving down
yeah.
the road just whispering a little prayer about
yeah.
something that comes to mind.
Mm-hmm.
Or I'm sitting here maybe even watching a football game on TV and all of a sudden I'm thinking about something and I pray for this person,
yeah.
I pray for that person. I try to not make prayer a... It's like evangelism. Mm-hmm. That's who I am. It's not what I do. It's the way I function.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. As far as mentor or encourager, who would you say, you know, maybe one or two individuals throughout your life who have really kind of poured into your life?
The first people that come to my mind is about five men in the church that I grew up in when I was a teenage boy. Several of them were deacons, but this was something they just took upon themselves in the spring through the fall, about once a weekend, one weekend a month. They would take us camping somewhere, just Friday night to Saturday. And just to be with those men and have devotions and have prayer and just swim with them, fish with them, and just laugh. They became, even as a teenager, they were some of my best friends, and I really learned a lot from them.
So would you say that just in that their lifestyle kind of rubbed off on you?
Their lifestyle, their faithfulness, their servant heart just was... I've thought about it and talked about it with some of the other boys that we went camping, and they all tell you about the same thing. That was the turning point in their life.
Wow. So it's even, in some senses, it's sort of a legacy of faithfulness, not only that you exhibit, but also that was exhibited for you as it kind of going down the road. Mm-hmm. Awesome. We're going to kind of shift gears a little bit in here, and we're going to kind of hit some kind of more targeted kind of ideas. One of the conversations that we're constantly having, particularly in our corner of the evangelical world, is this idea of topical preaching versus expository preaching. And what would be your preference?
I like expository now. I used to like topical just because it was, but expository.
What was the change for you?
I think as I grew and become more and more, as I could read the Bible and grow spiritually, then I could hear, oh, okay, that's what this means. That, rather than just hearing about David and Goliath or John the Baptist, putting the meat and all the words together there.
Do you have a favorite Christian author?
Not really. I probably have read more of Max Lucado's books than anybody. I've read several of his.
What is the what's the best book you've ever read?
The Bible.
Okay, good. Well, that solves that question. All right. So just in terms of kind of tools that you're reading, you said your Bible is definitely the best book you've ever read. What are, do you prefer a study Bible, or do you prefer just text in the book?
Text in the book.
Okay. Do you prefer, who's your favorite preacher other than the one you were currently sitting under?
Tim Melton. He was our pastor in Spain, a man that preached to about maybe 30 or 40 different nationalities on any particular Sunday, and the simplicity and the meat at the same time.
Wow. That is really impressive.
I was hoping you'd say me, but I mean...
I haven't heard you for a while.
And there's a reason for that. what's one characteristic you believe every follower of Christ should possess?
Humility.
It's a good one. Andrew, you taking notes there, bud? what's the one behavior or trait that you think derails more Christians in their walk with Christ?
I'd say pride.
The inverse, right?
Yeah. Absolutely. Why do you think that more professing Christians are not disciple makers or perceive themselves as disciples?
Probably fear or lack of maybe their own self, thinking they don't understand well enough, or they would not want to get into a conversation where I don't have the answer to that.
Very cool. Very good. What's your favorite book of the Old Testament?
Exodus.
Why Exodus?
It's just, I love reading about the children of Israel and all the things that they went through and how God led them and directed them, and just there's so much in that book.
So what about the New Testament? What's your favorite book of the New Testament?
Probably James.
And what gravitates you towards James?
James is easy reading and very full of common sense.
Now, if you had to nail down your favorite verse of the Bible, what would you give us?
Go ahead.
No, oh. I gotta let you say it. I don't know if I'm right.
There's so many. My mind's going 10 different directions right now.
You can give us a few, that's fine.
Well, I like 1 Corinthians 10:13, mm-hmm. where it says there's no temptation taking you but such as common to man.
Mm-hmm.
God is faithful and not allow you to be tempted above that which you're able, but will with that temptation make a way to escape.
Mm-hmm.
One of the others, it's a whole story, but the verse in Exodus, and this is why I like Exodus so well,
mm-hmm.
when God gave Moses the instructions to build the temple, and he started telling the people what they needed to build it, and all he asked for was faithfulness. Be faithful, mm-hmm. be faithful, be faithful, and willing, and willing, and willing. And then at the end, Moses had to tell the people to quit bringing because they had more than enough.
Yep.
And I think that's such a... That has stood out to me more than probably any other passage I ever read in the Bible.
Very cool. Very cool. Now, just one, if you don't mind my asking, I hear a lot of King James in the way that you're mm-hmm. quoting some of these favorite verses and some of these verses that have impacted your life so much. Is there a particular reason why you hold on to that King James, or is it just because that's what you grew up with? Or
that's what I grew up with. Mm-hmm. I have no problem with some of the other translations, but because of the scriptures, I can quote a lot of scripture. I can't always tell you the scripture or the chapter or verse.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But yet when I hear a verse and I think I know that, and many times I'll go back to the King James just to make sure that, yeah, that's right.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not that I have one over the other.
Mm-hmm.
I just, when I was young and was able to memorize, and it's just there.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I don't think it's the only one.
Well, Doug, would you mind closing this episode in a word of prayer?
Father, we thank you for this time together. We thank you that you have brought some men together that are concerned about evangelism and spreading the gospel. And we thank you for the time to share your word with others. We thank you for your faithfulness to us, and we just pray that we would remain faithful to the end. In your name, amen.
Thank you, Doug, for joining us for this episode. See you next time.
As always, thank you for listening to People in Exile. For more information, visit the website, peopleinexile.com, and make sure to follow us on Facebook. Until next time, keep praying and seeking the welfare of your city.